Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our December 13th service. Reverend Bodie and Catherine McNabb do a dramatic reading from Truman Capote's A Christmas Memory. Thanks for listening.
As we are making our journey towards Christmas today, earlier in the service, we lit the third candle of Christmas, the candle of love, and to me, as I've said on a number of occasions, this is the candle that comes closest to the heart of Christmas, and that's because Christmas has to do with the heart, and the heart has to do with love, and love is the word in English that we use to speak about our connections to, well, anything and everything, to flowers, to friends, to people, to places, to philosophies. We use the word love to speak of our connection to any of these things. It's the word that we use to get at the fact that we are linked, each and all, in a single fabric of reality. I think of it as one unbroken, universal, physical, spiritual happening. And because we are part of this one great gravitational energy field of being and becoming, we might experience our connections in that field most anywhere. So you don't know what's going to catch you, where you're going to make the connection. And this Christmas season is the time when especially we pay attention to those things that have caught us. To assist you in this process of reflecting upon where you have been caught, what has touched you, Catherine McNabb and I are going to read excerpts from a short story of Truman Capote that has to do with one of his ties of love, something very important to him, particularly in his early life. It's an autobiographical story. It was written when Capote was in college, published in December of 1956 in a magazine. Mademoiselle was the name of the magazine. And the title of the short story is A Christmas Memory. A couple of facts might be helpful here for you as you listen to this story. Truman Capote's parents were divorced when he was a youngster, just 4 years old. And so he was shipped off to live with distant relatives, away from his parents, in the rural area of Monroeville, Alabama, and he stayed there for a number of years. A number of the relatives in whose house he was staying were, in Capote's youthful eyes, quote, authoritarian and stern. But there was another distant relative, an older cousin about 65 years old, who he described as eccentric and childlike. And that woman, that distant cousin, was his best friend in childhood. Now, this older cousin is not named in the original story, which is the one that we're going to read, but in later adaptations of A Christmas Memory, she is called Sook. Her actual name is Nanny Rumbly Falk. Also in the house is a dog named Queenie. Our story is set in the 1930s when the story's narrator, that's the author Truman Capote, when he was just a youngster, 7 years old. And in our story, he is called Buddy. That's the name that his older cousin gave to him. And she's remembering the best friend in her childhood, when she was a child. That friend was named Buddy. He had died 50 years ago in the 1880s. The story, a part we won't read, relates how his older cousin and Buddy would make fruitcakes every holiday season in November. And they would gather pecans in a buggy. Actually, that was Truman Capote's baby carriage that was purchased when he was a youngster. And then they would save up their dimes, their nickels, and their pennies to buy the other ingredients for the fruitcakes. $12.73, says this story. Those other ingredients that they bought included a bottle of bootleg whiskey. You need that, apparently, for making their kinds of fruitcakes. It took them 4 days. They made 31 fruitcakes. And then after making them, they sent them to persons both that they knew and persons they didn't know, including the president of the United States at that time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In the selection we are about to read, a buddy and his best friend, his older cousin, have just finished sending off these fruitcakes, and now they celebrate that event by drinking the rest of the whiskey that's in the bootleg bottle, and they drink it straight. Somewhat tipsy and singing and dancing, they are caught by their other relatives in the house, who severely scold the older woman, somewhat understandably, you might think, for serving whiskey to a 7-year-old child. So, chastised, they retreat to her bedroom along with Queenie the dog, and that's where we're going to pick up the story. I'm going to read the parts of the narrator, Truman Capote, and Catherine McNabb is going to read the parts of the author's lively older cousin. I want to thank David Hundhausen. He unfortunately couldn't be here today, but he's the one who made the excerpts for the story that we are about to read. I think he did a really beautiful job in excerpting this longer, short story. So, A Christmas Memory by Truman Capote. Long after the town has gone to sleep and the house is silent, except for the chimings of clocks and the sputter of fading fires, my friend is weeping into a pillow already as wet as a widow's handkerchief. Don't cry, I say, sitting at the bottom of her bed and shivering despite my flannel nightgown that smells of last winter's cough syrup. Don't cry, I beg, teasing her toes, tickling her feet. You're too old for that.
It's because I am too old. Old and funny.
Not funny. Fun. More fun than anybody. Listen, if you don't stop crying, you'll be so tired tomorrow we can't cut a tree. She straightens up. Queenie jumps on the bed where Queenie is not allowed to lick her cheeks.
I know where we'll find real pretty trees, buddy. And holly, too, with berries as big as your eyes. It's way off in the woods, further than we've ever been. Papa used to bring us Christmas trees from there, carry them on his shoulders. That's 50 years ago. Well, now, I can't wait for morning.
Morning. Frozen rime frost lusters the grass. The sun, round as an orange as hot weather moons, balances on the horizon, burnishes the silvered winter woods. A wild turkey calls. A renegade hog grunts in the undergrowth. Soon, by the edge of knee-deep, rapid-running water, we have to abandon the buggy. Queenie wades the stream first, paddles across, barking complaints at the swiftness of the current, the pneumonia-making coldness of it. We follow, holding our shoes and equipment, a hatchet, a burlap sack above our heads. On the farther shore, Queenie shakes herself and trembles. My friend shivers too, not with cold, with enthusiasm. One of her hat's ragged roses sheds a petal as she lifts her head and inhales the pine-heavy air.
We're almost there. You can smell it, buddy.
She says as though we were approaching an ocean. And indeed, it is a kind of ocean. Scented acres of holiday trees, prickly-leafed holly, red berries shiny as Chinese bells, black crows swoop upon them screaming. Having stuffed our burlap bags with enough greenery and crimson to garland a dozen windows, we set about choosing a tree.
It should be twice as tall as a boy, so that boy can't steal the star.
The one we pick is twice as tall as me, a brave, handsome brute that survives 30 hatchet strokes before it keels with a creaking, rending cry. Lugging it like a kill, we commence the long trek out. Every few yards, we abandon the struggle, sit down, and pant. But we have the strength of triumphant huntsmen. That and the tree's virile, icy perfume revive us, goad us on. Many compliments accompany our sunset return along the red clay road to town. But my friend is sly and noncommittal when passersby praise the treasure perched in our buggy. What a fine tree, and where did it come from?
Yonder ways,
she murmurs vaguely. Once a car stops, and the rich mill owner's lazy wife leans out and whines, "Give you 2 bits cash for that old tree." Ordinarily, my friend is afraid of saying no, but on this occasion, she promptly shakes her head.
"We wouldn't take a dollar."
The mill owner's wife persists, "A dollar, my foot! 50 cents, that's my last offer. Goodness, woman, you can get another one." In answer, my friend gently reflects,
"I doubt it. There's never 2 of anything."
Home, Queenie slumps by the fire and sleeps till tomorrow, snoring loud as a human. A trunk in the attic contains
a shoebox of ermine tails off the opera cape of a curious lady who once rented a room in the house. Coils of frazzled tinsel gone gold with age, 1 silver star, a brief rope, a dilapidated, undoubtedly dangerous candy-like black bulbs.
Excellent decorations as far as they go, which isn't far enough. My friend wants our tree to blaze
like a Baptist window,
droop with weighty snows of ornament. But we can't afford the made-in-Japan splendors at the 5 and dime, so we do what we've always done. Sit for days at the kitchen table with scissors and crayons and stacks of colored paper. I make sketches, and my friend cuts them out.
Lots of cats, fish too, because they're easy to draw. Some apples and watermelons, a few winged angels devised from saved-up sheets of Hershey bar tinfoil. We use safety pins to attach these creations to the tree. As a final touch, we sprinkle the branches with shredded cotton picked in August for that purpose.
My friend, surveying the effect, clasps her hands together.
"Now, honest, buddy, doesn't that look good enough to eat?"
Queenie tries to eat an angel. After weaving and ribboning holly wreaths for all the front windows, our next project is the fashioning of family gifts.
Tie-dye scarves for the ladies, for the men a home-brewed lemon and licorice aspirin syrup to be taken at the first symptoms of a cold and after hunting.
But when it comes time for making each other's gift, my friend and I separate to work secretly. I would like to buy her a pearl-handled knife, a radio, a whole pound of chocolate-covered cherries. We tasted some once, and she always swears,
"I could live on them, buddy. Lord, yes, I could." And that's not taking his name in vain.
Instead, I am building her a kite. She would like to give me a bicycle. She said so on several million occasions.
If I only could, buddy. It's bad enough in life to do without something you want. But confounded, what gets my goat is not being able to give something to someone that you want them to have. Only one of these days I will, buddy, locate you a bike. Don't ask how. Steal it, maybe.
Instead, I'm fairly certain she is building me a kite, the same as last year and the year before. The year before that, we exchanged slingshots, all of which is fine by me, for we are champion kite flyers who study the wind like sailors. My friend, more accomplished than I, can get a kite aloft where there isn't enough breeze to carry clouds. Christmas Eve afternoon, we scrape together a nickel and go to the butcher's to buy Queenie's traditional gift.
A good, gnawable beef bone. The bone, wrapped in funny paper, is placed high on the tree near the silver star. Queenie knows it's there. She squats at the foot of the tree, staring up in a trance of greed. When bedtime arrives, she refuses to budge.
Her excitement is equaled by my own. I kick the covers and turn my pillow as though it were a scorching summer's night. Somewhere a rooster crows, falsely, for the sun is still on the other side of the world.
Buddy, are you awake?
It is my friend calling from her room, which is next to mine, and an instant later she is sitting on my bed holding a candle.
Well, I can't sleep a hoot. My mind's jumping like a jackrabbit. Buddy, do you think Mrs. Roosevelt will serve our cake at dinner?
We huddle in the bed, and she squeezes my hand. I love you.
Seems like your hand used to be much smaller. I guess I hate to see you grow up. When you're grown up, will we still be friends?
I say always.
But I feel so bad, buddy. I wanted to give you a bike. I tried to sell my cameo Papa gave me. Buddy.
She hesitates as though embarrassed.
I made you another kite.
Then I confess that I made her one too, and we laugh. The candle burns too short to hold. Out it goes, exposing the starlight, the stars spinning at the window like a visible caroling that slowly, slowly daybreak silences. Possibly we doze. But the beginnings of dawn splash us like cold water. We're up, wide-eyed and wandering while we wait for others to waken. Quite deliberately, my friend drops a kettle on the kitchen floor. I tap dance in front of closed doors. One by one, the household emerges, looking as though they'd like to kill us both, but it's Christmas, so they can't. First, a gorgeous breakfast, just everything you can imagine, from flapjacks and fried squirrel to hominy grits and honey in the comb, which puts everyone in a good humor, except my friend and me. Frankly, we're so impatient to get at the presents, we can't eat a mouthful. Well, I'm disappointed. And who wouldn't be with socks, a Sunday school shirt, some handkerchiefs, a hand-me-down sweater, and a year's subscription to a religious magazine for children, The Little Shepherd? It makes me boil. It really does. My friend has a better haul.
A sack of satsumas.
That's her best present. She is proudest, however, of...
a white wool shawl knitted by my married sister.
But she says her favorite gift is the kite I built her. And it is very beautiful, though not as beautiful as the one she made me, which is blue and scattered with gold and green good conduct stars. Moreover, my name is painted on it, Buddy.
Buddy, the wind is blowing.
The wind is blowing, and nothing will do till we've run to a pasture below the house where Queenie has scooted to bury her bone, and where a winter hence Queenie will be buried too. There, plunging through the healthy, waist-high grass, we unreel our kites, feel them twitching at the string like skyfish as they swim into the wind. Satisfied, sun-warmed, we sprawl in the grass and peel satsumas and watch our kites cavort. Soon I forget the socks and the hand-me-down sweater. I'm as happy as if we'd already won the $50,000 grand prize in that coffee-naming contest.
My, how foolish I am.
My friend cries, suddenly alert, like a woman remembering too late she has biscuits in the oven.
You know what I've always thought?
She asks in a tone of discovery, and not smiling at me, but at a point beyond.
I've always thought a body would have to be sick and dying before they saw the Lord. And I imagine when he came, it'd be like looking at a Baptist window, pretty as colored glass with the sun pouring through, such a shine that you don't know it's getting dark. And it's been a comfort to think of that shine taking away all the spooky feeling. But I'll wager it never happens. I'll wager at the very end a body realizes the Lord has already shown himself. That things as they are...
Her hand gestures in a circles in a gesture that gathers clouds and kites and grass and Queenie pawing earth over her bone.
Just what they've always seen was seeing him. That's for me. I could leave the world with today in my eyes.
This is our last Christmas together. Life separates us. Those who know best decide I belong in a military school. And so follows a miserable succession of bugle-blowing prisons and grim, reveille-ridden summer camps. I have a new home, too, but it doesn't count. Home is where my friend is, and there I never go. And there she remains, puttering around the kitchen, alone with Queenie, then alone.
Buddy, dear.
She writes in her wild, hard-to-read script.
Yesterday, Jim Macy's horse kicked Queenie bad. Be thankful she didn't feel much. I wrapped her in a fine linen sheet and rode her in the buggy down to Simpson's pasture where she can be with all of her bones.
For a few Novembers, she continues to bake her fruitcakes single-handed. Not as many, but some. And of course, she always sends me...
the best of the batch.
Also, in every letter, she encloses a dime wadded in toilet paper.
See a picture show and write me the story.
But gradually in her letter, she tends to confuse me with her other friend, the buddy who died in the 1880s. More and more, 13ths are not the only days she stays in bed. A morning arrives in November, a leafless, birdless coming of winter morning, when she cannot arouse herself to exclaim,
oh my, it's fruitcake weather.
And when that happens, I know it. A message saying so merely confirms a piece of news some secret vein had already received, severing from me an irreplaceable part of myself, letting it loose like a kite on a broken string. That is why, walking across the school campus on this particular December morning, I keep searching the sky as if I expected to see, rather like hearts, a lost pair of kites hurrying toward heaven.